welcome to the Science Podcast for September 28th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how did social insects evolve to be altruistic? New evidence that confirms ancient Polynesians traveled thousands of kilometers by canoe to engage in trade. And what makes a good scientific image? The results are in from our visualization challenge.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Would you give up sex and just work to feed your siblings? That's what drone honeybees do. And if you've ever been stung, you also know that a honeybee gives up its life with that sting to protect its colony. This altruistic or eusocial behavior of bees and some other insects has intrigued scientists for a long time. Now, Amy Toth and colleagues have looked to the genes expressed in paper wasps for clues to understanding that behavior. I spoke to Toth from her office at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign.
We're interested in trying to understand the origins of social behavior in animals. And the reason that's so interesting is because it's really been a long-standing mystery that's intrigued many biologists, even since Darwin. Because typically you think in evolution, an animal's goal in life is to survive and reproduce. So how do we explain something as extreme as, for example, a honeybee that stings and loses its life to defend its colony? And so the question we're asking is, where does this type of unselfish or altruistic behavior come from?
Now, aren't there several hypotheses out there to account for this? Inclusive fitness and super sisters, super organism, things like that?
Yep. So these kinds of questions have been of great interest for quite a long time. And I think there are many ways to approach it. One is trying to understand the forces of evolution that create this type of behavior. Our approach is a little bit different. It's to look at the proximate cues that may have led to the evolution of this type of behavior. So trying to understand what types of precursor behaviors may exist in certain forms of animals that may predispose them to becoming highly social.
Okay, so what was your hypothesis going into this experiment then?
We hypothesized that there would be a similar biological basis underlying maternal behavior and altruistic or worker behavior in a social insect. And so if those two behaviors were related in an evolutionary sense, then you might expect them to have very similar types of underlying biological basis.
So the one evolved from the other?
Yeah, so the idea would be that maternal or parental behavior is much more widespread across the animal kingdom. You see it in many different groups of animals. And so the idea would be that that could have come first and could have served as sort of a stepping stone towards higher forms of sociality.
Okay, so how did you test this hypothesis?
So we tested this by measuring patterns of brain gene activity or gene expression, and we focused on naturally occurring behavior in a native species, North American species of paper wasp called Polistes metricus.
Why did you focus on them?
So paper wasps are really ideal for addressing this type of evolutionary question. They have complex societies with queens and workers, but their social organization is somewhat more primitive than what you see in honeybees, for example. And in fact, when colonies begin, they start with a single mom, which is called a foundress. And these were actually a key group for our study because they're performing maternal behavior in the absence of any other colony members. And you don't see anything like that in honeybees. And so the single mom will work to rear a set of daughters, and those become the workers. And after the workers emerge, they take over caring for the offspring. And the foundress becomes a queen, and you have your complex society forming.
As compared with bees, which start off with a...
Exactly. So when bees start a colony, they found in swarms. And so the queen actually never is, although she lays lots of eggs, she never is engaging in maternal behavior.
So you looked at DNA or RNA or what in looking at these two different groups?
Right. So we're interested in looking at patterns of gene activity in the brain and how those differed between the different groups of wasps that I just described. And we focused on RNA. So that would be genes that are being actively transcribed in the brain.
And how had you identified which genes you wanted to look at? Were these from the much more widely studied honeybee?
Mm-hmm. They were from all derived from honeybee studies. And they were genes that had been previously identified from various different labs and different methodologies as being associated with foraging behavior in honeybees, which is an important element of the worker behavior. And then some of them also had appeared to have roles in determination of who becomes a queen and who becomes a worker in honeybee societies. So they all seemed like very interesting candidates that could potentially show differences in the wasp species.
So what kind of overlap was there then between the paper wasp and the honeybee?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we can't answer that definitively because we handpicked our genes. And so what we'd really need to do is pick a random set from wasps and a random set from bees to get an unbiased estimate of what the overlap was. And so what we can say is based on the 32 genes that we did look at, and we probably picked genes that are more interesting and potentially more likely to show differences, we saw about 62% of those showed differences in the wasp that were associated with behavior. So it was a very high percentage were showing interesting differences in gene activity in the brains of the wasp.
Did the expression of these genes back up what had been observed in the wasp as far as how it was different than the honeybee in terms of the rearing behavior of the wasps?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of them did, I'd say, follow up with an expectation we had. So as I mentioned before, some of the genes that we chose were associated with foraging behavior in honeybees. And in fact, a big part of being a worker or being a maternal foundress in these wasp colonies is foraging. And so we actually saw quite a few of the genes that were associated with foraging in honeybees. They also appeared to be turned on or turned off in specific ways in the brains of wasps that were foraging. And this foraging is an essential part of being maternal or being a worker.
So both groups are eusocial, but wasps are more maternal in their gene expression than the bees are, at least the ones that were queens.
Right. So the wasps, they have a maternal group, whereas the bees don't. And so that was the important comparison. And so what was unknown from previous studies with honeybees is what did a maternal gene expression pattern look like? And so we were able to do that with the paper wasp because we had this interesting group called foundresses and compare that to workers. And then I think some of the things that we'd like to do in the future would be to do more cross-species comparisons and see if the types of gene expression patterns we see in the brains of honeybee workers are also similar to maternal gene expression patterns in paper wasps or other types of insects that show maternal behavior.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Amy Toth is lead author of a paper on the evolutionary link between maternal behavior and eusociality, published online this week by Science at www.scienceexpress.org. Also on Science Express this week, a burst of radio waves from outside our galaxy. On the hunt for pulsars, Duncan Lorimer and colleagues report that they instead found millisecond bursts of radio waves. They estimate these waves were generated more than 3 billion light years away, and that their source could be used to probe the distant reaches of the universe. Read the paper, A Bright Millisecond Radio Burst of Extragalactic Origin, at www.scienceexpress.org. How far would you go for a good woodworking tool? How about 4,000 kilometers, without a map, in a canoe, with no land in sight? This is not a typical dash to the hardware store. Instead, it describes what is thought to be a trade route that islanders in the Pacific took between what is now French Polynesia and Hawaii. Kenneth Collarson and Marshall Weisler report in a paper in this week's Science that they've traced this 4,000-kilometer route by examining the geochemistry of centuries-old stone tools called adzes that are used in woodworking. I spoke to Collarson from Brisbane, Australia, where he works at the University of Queensland.
Well, this paper that we've just had published in Science is really a unique discovery. What we have found is an adze, which is a tool, stone tool, manufactured from a basalt, that we've been able to identify the source of the basalt as coming from Hawaii. And this is really a fantastic discovery. Other people have looked at stone tools in Eastern Pacific for many years, and have tried various techniques to identify their sources. But until our discovery, none of these techniques really were definitive, and none of them actually allowed the identification of an ADS that had come from Hawaii. Other sources that had been identified were all in the region of French Polynesia, whereas Hawaii is more than 4,000 kilometres away from this locality.
Where were these ADSs found?
The ADSs that we studied were actually sourced from the Bishop Museum in Hawaii. And our ability to obtain this material from the Bishop Museum largely came about as a result of the contacts that my collaborator, Marshall Weisler, had developed over many years through his studies in Hawaii, mainly working on West Molokai and in other areas. So we were able to sample stone ADSs from the Bishop Museum. Now, these ADSs had been collected in the 1930s, and they came from a low coral island in the northwest Tuamotu archipelago in French Polynesia, and this is about 4,000 kilometres from Hawaii. They were collected in this island archipelago during the course of phosphate mining activity, and the person who was able to collect them was an anthropologist called Kenneth Emery, and he lodged his collection with the Bishop Museum. Now, we were able to sample small volumes of these ADSs by drilling out a centimetre diameter core that was about a quarter of a centimetre deep. And with this very small amount of material, we could do not only major element chemistry and trace element chemistry, but also a suite of trace of isotopic compositions involving lead, strontium, and neodymium isotopic compositions.
What exactly did you find in these ADSs?
Okay, well, we analysed 19 ADSs, and they were collected from an archipelago in French Polynesia where there was no rock outcropping except for limestone and phosphate rock. So there were no local sources. And what we did was measure the isotopic composition as well as the major element and the trace element composition, and this provided us with the database with which to try and compare the ADS compositions with the chemistries that had been identified by other workers and by ourselves for volcanic sources in Polynesia and in Hawaii.
Do those sources differ somehow?
Oh, yes. Within one of the important features of the so-called ocean island basalts, these are the little volcanic chains that punctuate the Pacific Ocean basin and also occur in the Atlantic Ocean and Indian Ocean. Hawaii is one example of one of these very long-lived ocean island basalt suites. What we have studied from what we've learned from geochemistry is that individual ocean island basalts are different in certain of their isotopic compositions and trace element ratios, and these differences have been interpreted to reflect differences in the sources of these basalts, either in the upper mantle or possibly even in the lower mantle. And so the unique chemistries that are available for the ocean island basalts allows us to compare the chemistries of the ADSs and therefore try and identify the sources from which the basalts that the ADSs were fashioned from might have come.
Now, these ADSs came over as part of the trade.
In the course of our study, we have found that not only have we discovered an ADS that came from Hawaii, but we've also found sources in the Marquesas, the Australis societies, and also the Pitcairn Island group. And this covers a vast area of French Polynesia, so it shows that there was a tremendous amount of cultural exchange going on within East Polynesia.
Are there any other explanations for how this particular ADS from Hawaii came to be in the French Polynesians?
We can see no other explanation. It was clearly made in Polynesia in the Tuamotu region because of the style of the ADS. According to Marshall's interpretation, it's not a typical Hawaiian-style ADS, and we made that point in the paper.
Right.
But the rock is unlike anything from in French Polynesia. And the rock has to have had to come from Hawaii. There's no question about that.
Now to the science of that a little bit, what in particular? Is there a chemical composition or some sort of other way?
Yeah, there's several chemical features that really point to Hawaii. In terms of trace element composition, there's a critical trace element ratio of barium to thorium. So we take the barium to thorium ratio. Most ocean island basalts have barium to thorium ratios less than 100.
And Hawaii?
Hawaii and one location in the Atlantic Ocean has a barium to thorium ratio of greater than 100. And one island in the Societies we've identified has a barium to thorium ratio greater than 100. So the options are, is this adds came from this one island in French Polynesia with a barium to thorium ratio of 100, or from Hawaii. Now, the main difference with the island in French Polynesia is that its lead isotopic composition is totally different from that of Hawaii, but the ADS has an isotopic composition in lead that is identical to the lead isotopic composition of Kilauea rocks.
It seems like you've pretty well settled it then, that the rock is from the area. What's next then along this research path?
What this discovery does, it opens up the field of archaeometry to a new approach in terms of sourcing. And what we've done, I believe, is set the bar very high in terms of the techniques that now must be applied in studying the sources of stone artifacts, to look in much more detail at the sources of different artifacts, adzes throughout Polynesia.
Is that what you'll be looking at next? More adzes?
Well, if we can obtain funding to do it. And as you know, with science these days, it's all down to funding.
I understand. Well, thank you very much.
I appreciate being approached, and we look forward to seeing the paper appear in Science.
Kenneth Collarson, together with Marshall Weisler, report on the composition of stone tools and early Polynesian travel in the September 28th issue of Science. Also this week in Science, prehistoric genomes from hair. Tom Gilbert and colleagues examined the hair shafts of 13 woolly mammoths and found that they could sequence the DNA in the mitochondria, the cell's energy producer. The researchers hope that this new source of ancient DNA will lead to a better understanding of organisms from long ago, including extinct species like the woolly mammoth. Read Whole Genome Shotgun Sequencing of Mitochondria from Ancient Hair Shafts in this week's Science. Finally today, what makes for a winning science visualization? I spoke with Felice Frankel about it. She's an artist and senior research fellow at Harvard University, and among her other accomplishments, has done many covers for leading scientific magazines, including Science. She was also a judge in the 2007 International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, the results of which are published this week in Science and on the journal's website. I spoke to her from her home office in Western Massachusetts.
The idea is to find ways of communicating ideas and data visually. And the important word here is communication. And that's what the challenge was about. Not only is it to clarify ideas, but clearly express them and communicate them. And that's why we chose the winners we chose.
So the images can't just be beautiful or technologically advanced or superbly accurate. They really need to say something right off the bat when it hits you, or do you need to...
Yeah, well, or exactly. At some point, they have to say something and get you to want to look. I think that's a really important piece that so many researchers miss. In my opinion, the idea is to get people engaged, but not just making a pretty picture. That term is used often. There is nothing wrong with a pretty picture if, in fact, there is information in the picture. But first and foremost, I think the idea is to engage somebody, to want to see what's going on in the image or whatever expression they're creating.
It doesn't matter so much if the picture or visualization or whatever it is, website even, uses something that's been digitally manipulated, given all the different technologies that are out there. It just needs to communicate.
Well, I think the important thing for us in science is to always always, that's underlined and said 100 times, tell the viewer if there is any manipulation going on. That's what separates what we're doing in this challenge and what we look at in the challenge. That's what's different from art. We have to be as objective as possible in the way we communicate science. But of course, there's nothing completely objective. I mean, even in the notion of taking a photograph, the very nature of framing a picture is a decision that you make. But to your question, I do think it is appropriate to manipulate an image in order to clarify the information that you want to communicate. But once again, you must always indicate that you're doing so.
Well, with the various ways of manipulating all these different images, besides the framing of a photograph and the technology of a photograph itself, is it still possible to put together a really compelling, driving image without needing to use the digital technology in some way?
Oh, absolutely. Goodness, I sure hope so. there is one particular winner. It's a quite stunning image of Iris Seamoss made by Andrea, I think her name is Addison, in Maryland. The thing about the image, It is somewhat manipulated in the sense that she removed the background that was on the original image and created a black background.
Okay.
But in reality, the specimen itself was not manipulated, just the background. And I suggest that is, even though it's dramatically changed, I don't think that it's a high manipulation in the sense of the original specimen is exactly what it should be.
To that image, that particular image, what is it that is communicating? What does that get at?
Well, I think first and foremost, I want to look at it. I mean, I have to tell you very honestly, I've walked along beaches and sort of seen sea moss, I suppose, and occasionally picked it up, but I've never wanted to study it the way I want to study this because it's so unbelievably, stunningly beautiful. And it's very simple, actually, in that she spread it out so you could really see all the detail. And the way she lit it was, in fact, very simple. It was just outdoor lighting, no manipulation at all in the lighting, nothing sophisticated. But I think the simplicity of it engages you in the sense it's so simple. Yet, of course, it's really not because it's a biological system. But you're not embarrassed to look at it. You're drawn to it because of the simplicity. And I think this is one of the biggest problems we have in when we see other forms of expression in science. Scientists tend to put as much data and as much stuff in an image as they can. Maybe it's to show that they could do it. But this, I think, is the mistake all of us make, that we just have too much to look at. If we could just edit out material and just focus on, literally and metaphorically, focus on what we want to look at, I think that's the direction most of us should start heading in. I know that I try to do that.
Would you say that's sort of your biggest challenge in working in this field? Obviously, you have to communicate a lot and work a lot with scientists who are doing this work.
Yeah, it is very much of a challenge. First of all, to have them agree with you. You know, everybody thinks that they know more than you know, and most of the time they do in terms of the science. But as far as what works visually, I think the very first question one must ask is, what is the purpose of this image? What is it you want me to look at? And you know, you'd be surprised how many scientists can't answer that quickly.
Well, thank you for sharing your perspective on all of this.
This has been my pleasure.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
You bet.
Felice Frankel served as a judge in the 5th Annual International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, a contest sponsored by Science and the National Science Foundation. You can read the stories and view an online slideshow of the winning entries from the competition at www.sciencemag.org/SCIEXT/VIS2007. Because of a staff retreat this week, we're unable to have our usual weekly visit with the editors of Science Now, but they'll be back in next week's show. Meanwhile, check out the latest news online at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. For now, that wraps up the September 28th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.